Hey there, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Classic Gaming Brothers. I'm Seth.
And I'm Zach.
And we are the Classic Gaming Brothers.
Always classic, sometimes classy. That one's for the true fans out there.
True fans. We literally brought it back.
Yeah, but that's still for the true fans.
That's true. We should go back and listen to some of our really early episodes to see if there's any sort of like zingers that we thought were going to be our zingers forever, and then we just forgot the very next week.
There was inside jokes like titular character, the Jim Raynor of StarCraft.
The Jim Raynor.
I always loved that when we were talking about StarCraft, you said Jim Raynor was the titular character.
Yeah. Because you can't have StarCraft without Jim Raynor.
Right, but the game is not called Jim Raynor Craft.
It should be called Jim Raynor Craft.
It should be called Jim Raynor Craft.
That'd be a great game. It's just like Jim Raynor just sighing.
Oh no, can you imagine though if someone did a mod where it's like StarCraft 2, but all the units are Jim Raynor? Every single unit spawns and just goes, "This is Jimmy."
I'm pretty sure you could probably find that for StarCraft 1 easily.
I'd replace all the units with the same sprite though, so they're all the Vulture sprite, but they still perform the actions they're supposed to, so you have like Vulture SCVs.
Oh man, I wonder how difficult that would be. So, Zach, what have you recently been playing?
Seth, recently I've been playing Rise of the Triad Ludicrous Edition, released on July 31st of 2023. Rise of the Triad Ludicrous Edition is the Night Dive remaster of the classic game Rise of the Triad. It's an over-the-top, chaotic, frantic shooter where you gun down guys who kind of look like Nazis, but they're technically not Nazis. Now, the original Rise of the Triad came out in 1995 and was released by Apogee, and originally the game was intended to be a sequel to Wolfenstein 3D, to the point where the game actually uses the Wolfenstein engine, though heavily modified. You play as one of five possible characters, each part of an elite squad who are sent to investigate San Nicolas Island off the coast of LA, and your job is to stop a group called the Triad, who are not the Triad gang that is a real gang that exists in Asia. This Triad is a cult who dresses a lot like the Nazis. They wear like brown coats with the leather straps and boots, and they wear like crush caps, but they're definitely Americans because they don't scream fake German at you.
I always thought Rise of the Triad was regarding the Triad gang.
No, it's regarding Triad occult who look like Nazis. And they also have like cultists that wear like cloaks, so you know they're a cult. Now, Rise of the Triad Ludicrous Edition is the updated version. It includes updated frame rates, restored content, the inclusion of the 2013 remake soundtrack, which was probably the best part about the 2013 remake, updated multiplayer capabilities, a level editor, and one of the coolest things I think they included is a Doom total conversion called Return of the Triad, which they just dropped in for fun. Like, no reason for it to be there beyond the fact that Night Dive was like, let's give them everything that you could ever want. And Ludicrous Edition also includes all of the original Rise of the Triad. It includes Extreme Rise of the Triad, which was a official add-on. There is also a whole brand new campaign that you can play through, which includes new levels that have been designed by some of the original Rise of the Triad members, as well as some modern game designers and stuff, which is fun. It's just an overall great release of the game.
It's like a boomer shooter too, right?
If Wolfenstein is the goddaddy of boomer shooters, this is the awkward nephew of boomer shooters. Again, it is a Wolfenstein sequel based in the Wolfenstein engine, and when they were working on it, they decided to make it more like Doom, and that is Rise of the Triad. And Ludicrous Edition is everything and more. I love it. I think it's a great game. I definitely recommend picking it up if you're a fan of 90s shooters, especially if you're a fan of 90s shooters that are just over the top and silly. One of my favorite things in Rise of the Triad, I think I mentioned this in a previous episode when I was talking about Night Dive's work on the Dark Forces remaster, but in Rise of the Triad there is God Mode, which you can find. It's like a pickup in the level that gives you a temporary ability. When you get God Mode, not only are you invincible for a bit, but you can't access any of your weapons besides your hand, and your hand will shoot out an explosive energy beam that will just bounce around the screen and kill everything in its path. However, even better than God Mode is Dog Mode, where you become a dog and you bite people.
Oh, that sounds fun.
So that's Rise of the Triad, specifically Ludicrous Edition. Again, highly recommend picking it up if you like 90s shooters. And that's what I've been recently playing. Seth, what about you?
So recently, I've been playing a game that I've been excited for it to come out for a while. It's Mars After Midnight by Lucas Pope. I now own everything that Lucas Pope has sold for retail. And I believe played every game that he's released, whether it be freeware or not. I'm a big fan of Lucas Pope. He did Papers, Please and Return of the Obra Dinn, both phenomenal games. So then he did Mars After Midnight. However, he was doing it exclusively for the Playdate. Oh, don't you remember? At some point in time, Seth bought a Playdate. Was it perhaps because Lucas Pope was going to release an exclusive game on it? Yes, yes it was. Mars After Midnight came out on 3/12 of this year, 2024, and you play as a worker at the Off-Colony Community Support Center, who runs a variety of help sessions for Martians. And help sessions, the topics vary by day. So like one could be like anger management for Cyclopses. Another one might be one for Farters. And the sessions begin at 1 a.m. From midnight to 1 a.m., there's registration and refreshments. So you have to man a door and you have like a little flap and you open the flap with using the crank. And you look around and you can see if this Martian meets the criteria for the session that you're doing. So if you're looking for angry Cyclopses, you are looking for Cyclopses who look a little angry. Not happy Cyclopses, and not anyone with multiple eyes, only angry Cyclopses. And those are the ones that you need to bring in. And then you're to have refreshments available for them. And I think you have pie, and you have to make sure that the pie is available and the table is clean and it's nice. The problem is when people come in, they mess everything up. So you have to move everything around and pick everything up. And it's one of those games that Lucas Pope is very good at making, where there's somebody knocking at the door, you're trying to clean the table, you're scrubbing the table down, you're moving all the stuff around, and there's like knocking, and you're just like, oh, I gotta get everything done, and you feel like there's not enough time, but you could still get through it. So you have to help all these Martians, and it's a lot of fun. The art style is great. It runs perfect on the Playdate because Lucas Pope designed it for the Playdate, and Lucas Pope is a very good game designer. And so it's a lot of fun. If you have a Playdate, it's definitely worth the $6 cost. Check it out. Mars After Midnight by Lucas Pope, one of my all-time favorite developers. Now that he's done with Mars After Midnight, do you know what that means?
He can make a different game.
Correct. Which I'm excited about seeing what he has next in plan for his next endeavor. The thing with Lucas Pope, though, is that he's like, I would love to see another Obra Dinn type of game, but I don't think he likes to revisit things. I think he likes to think outside the box and do something else. So, as I'm sure people want to see, like a sequel to Papers, Please. Something like that.
So I guess that's the question is, do you think Lucas Pope's next game will be a Playdate game, or do you think he's going to go back to PC or choose some other niche system?
I don't know. To be honest, I really don't know. I wouldn't put money on it, but I would think that he would probably go back and do another PC game next. I don't know if he's going to do another Playdate game unless he fell in love with making a Playdate game.
Cool. Well, to get into today's episode, we're going to be talking about a game that's part of a genre that Seth loves, which are adventure games. We're talking about an adventure game that I don't think Seth's ever played, though.
I have.
Oh, you have played it?
No, I've played it recently, so I've played it after we've talked about it.
You didn't play it growing up.
I did not play it growing up, and if I did, my childhood would be even weirder than it already has been.
That's right, because we're talking about a game that I think we've alluded to a few times, and that game is Darkseid.
I do have some thoughts on Darkseid initially before you start going into all of the how it came to be and the seed of Darkseid. It is one of those obtuse adventure games, just as an FYI. If you are like, I like adventure games, and the Classic Gaming Brothers are talking about a fun old DOS game called Darkseid, just be aware, Darkseid is one of those adventure games, and if you don't do everything right, you will die, or the game will be over.
I also, like, mild content warning for if you do decide to play Darkseid, the visuals can be a little disturbing, yeah. Even for a 1992 game, and that's because of H.R. Giger. Like, H.R. Giger was heavily involved in the production, at least his art was. And if you're not familiar with Geiger's work, it is a little disturbing. It's very phallic. Like, I don't know if like body horror is something that you're not into, maybe avoid Darkseid.
Just keep on going. But yeah, so I've played a little bit of Darkseid. Even with a guide, the game is a little bit obtuse. Literally, like, these are the things you need to do. I tried playing it without a guide and I had no idea what to do. And then I start getting concerned that I'm just going to like waste time going down a wrong path or dying easily. And I tend to then try to go and get like a guide or something just to get little ideas of where to go. And then apparently as I was reading the guide, I was like, oh, this game is incredibly complex. I don't think it's as bad as the original King's Quest. It might be King's Quest 2. There is a bridge. And if you pass over the bridge 8 times, you are soft locked out of the game.
I think Darkseid has moments like that, but has a lot of moments like that. We'll talk about a bit more in the gameplay side, but Darkseid has things that you can do in the game can make the game unwinnable, and you won't know until you get to the end of the game.
Yeah, and I, as a person, so when I play games like Darkseid, because I want to be able to experience the weird DOS game that I might otherwise like, that's why I tend to go with guides, because I don't want to get soft-locked after. I don't want to play a game for 2 hours and then realize that I can't beat it ever and I have to restart it. Like, that's not what I find fun.
In my experience with Darkseid, I was introduced to Darkseid through YouTube. There's a YouTube gamer video guy called Peanut Butter Gamer who put out a video about Darkseid ages ago. I think I double checked. I think he put it out 13 years ago. And that's how I was introduced to Darkseid. And since then, I've been very interested by Darkseid and its oddity. There is a video that I sometimes will randomly send to Seth, and it's just a clip of Darkseid where the main character walks into a store and says,
"What a quaint general store with a little bit of everything for day-to-day existence."
I do think in the realm of weird and horrible adventure games, a horrible being like scary body horror type of adventure games, I do think Harvester is probably worse than Darkseid.
Yeah, I think Harvester's worse, and I Have No Mouth But I'm a Scream, which was also done by Cyber Dreams, is equally a bit more disturbing.
Yeah, on the light side of things, if you are somebody who enjoys body horror and those type of video games, there's a bunch of untapped 90s goodness that's available, of which one of those is Darkseid. I think probably the tamest one of them.
Which is going to be saying something.
Yeah. Like, compared to Harvester, it's tame.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't, like, murder innocent people in Darkseid like you can in Harvester.
Yeah, Harvester is just wild. And maybe it deserves its own episode, but not immediately after the Darkseid episode.
No. Now, to get into Darkseid and its history, we should talk about Cyber Dreams, the company that developed it. Cyber Dreams Interactive Entertainment was founded by Patrick Ketchum, who previously started the game company Datasoft. Datasoft was incredibly prolific back in the 1980s. They put out actually about 50 or so games between the years 1982 and 1988, and they also developed some educational software like mathematics and geography software. Now, some of the games that they put out were ports of arcade games to home computers. They did a port of Zaxxon, Puyen, Nibbler, Mr. Do, and Pac-Man. They also released some of their own games, like 221B Baker Street, Conan, Dallas Quest, Napoleon in Russia, Borodino, 1812, and Zorro, just to name a few. Despite the numerous releases, Datasoft would go bankrupt in 1987, reportedly per a forum post that I read on fambaboards.com, and I have no clue how true this post was. It was a big, long post about Datasoft. The bankruptcy was partially due to the fact that major investors had pulled out of the company, and one of their biggest investors was Gillette, the razor company, who had been a major investor in Datasoft, and in the 1980s, like late 80s, they pulled out their investments, thus causing Datasoft to be without any funds. So they had no funds, and their sales weren't enough to keep them afloat, so they went bankrupt. Patrick would not be deterred. He would actually go on to start up his new company, and with his new company, he would hire on designer Mike Dawson and programmer John Krause as early members of the Cyber Dreams team, and they began looking for a way to get into the world of adventure games. Their first game took one hell of a dive into that world, and this was because of who they brought in to work on this game, H.R. Geiger.
Born in 1940 in Switzerland, H.R. Geiger, for those who may not know, was a rather well-known artist for a very distinctive style. He specifically liked to depict biomechanical things, usually with a provocative or sexual nature to them. One of his better-known pieces of artwork is an image of what looks like four alien fetuses inside a cross-section of a pistol being loaded into the chamber of a pistol, and this piece is called Birth Machine. Another piece of his is Necronom 4, which depicts a creature with a very phallic head, served as the basis for a design of the xenomorph in the film Alien. So if you liked the alien iconography from like Ridley Scott's mind, it came from H.R. Giger. Giger's designs not only blend into the world of films, but some of his work has served as inspiration for furniture, instruments, and what Cyber Dreams hoped, video games. One immediate thing that Giger had a problem with was that the limitations Cyber Dream actually had. The team had hoped to use a mode of VGA that would provide a 320 by 200 resolution. Giger asked, as an artist, for more resolution. So the team increased that resolution to 640 by 350, but this meant that the game had to use less colors. And as an artist, he probably was also mad about that. With 320 by 200 resolution, the game could utilize 256 colors. At 640 by 350, it had to use the dreaded 16 colors.
Yeah.
And I remember as a child selecting those options before booting a game up. Oof. In the development of the games that Cyber Dreams was working on, Giger would provide access to his artwork, and the developers would end up using some of his pieces from the games. And unlike today, they didn't have some AI model just drill through all of Giger's works. They, in fact, looked at it with their human eyes and then tried to incorporate it into their game. One of these pieces by Giger, Lee 2, is the cover for the game's box, for Darkseid's box. The artwork, Lee 2, was actually based directly on Giger's girlfriend, Lee Tobler, who sadly took her own life sometime after the portrait that Giger did was done.
Certain pieces of artwork would be scanned in and utilized as background assets. In a July 2008 interview with the publication ImageFX, Giger actually lamented that he ultimately did not have much to do with the development of the game itself. He stated, quote-unquote, "They just used my name. I didn't create any new stuff for it." And he sounds kind of bummed when you read this article. He sounds like he really wanted to work on this game, like, personally. The chance to work with Giger was, by many accounts for members of the team, an incredibly unique opportunity. In an interview with GameDeveloper.com, Mike Dawson notes that working at Cyber Dreams was his first job, and with only a few months of starting that first job, he was flying to Europe to meet with H.R. Giger. And, like, just imagine, you're fresh out of college, you're starting your very first job at a startup company that has produced zero product, and they're like, "We're paying for you to fly to Europe to meet one of the most famous artists of all time. Like, this guy is the reason for Alien. You are meeting this guy and you're going to cement us a deal for our game." That must have been incredibly daunting, I imagine, for Mr. Dawson, but also probably really cool.
And set expectations for all future jobs.
That's true. Now, Mike Dawson's role on Darkseid wasn't just designing the game and securing this deal with Giger. He also served another important role completely by accident. You see, Mike Dawson is not only the namesake for the main character of Darkseid, he's also the model of the main character in Darkseid. So when you play Darkseid, the man you are walking around is Mike Dawson. That's his name. And that's who was playing him in the digitized graphics. In the GameDeveloper.com interview, Mike noted that he had put his name in as a placeholder, which apparently was just like a running gag with him and his friends when they were working on like small projects. He would put in his name as a placeholder. And apparently Mike's boss walked by and said, "I like that name, let's keep it." And Mike also said it probably helped that he did pick his own name because that meant they didn't need to hire a real actor.
I also think it's funny, there's an interview with him where he said that he ended up getting a fond attachment for the game because he put a lot of himself into it.
Yeah, he did.
Now, while Darkseid has many backgrounds that it shares with the work of Giger, the characters in the game are digitized actors. This makes a kind of surreal vibe to the game, as the characters will often stand out while standing in this disturbing set piece. To perform this, per a 1992 issue of the Compute magazine, the team would go on to scan body parts and parts of Geiger's collection using an Epson ES300C flatbed color scanner, import the images into Deluxe Paint 2E, and digitally assemble the pieces like a puzzle. Now, the game would go on to cost a lot of money, especially for a first game for a company. According to the publication CU Amiga, the game cost an estimated $600,000, which, if you brought that money to 2024 dollars, it's $1.3 million for a first game, so with no track record. So that's like Zach and I deciding we need to make a video game and we need $1.3 million to do it. And let me tell you, no one is going to give us that money. Now, a majority of this came from the endorsement for Geiger, who was reportedly paid in cash. The music in the game is, like the rest of it, also very surreal. It goes from creepy to somewhat lighthearted. For example, when you start the game, you have a constant droning music that is replicating your main character suffering from a severe migraine. Now you feel like you have a migraine after listening to that. However, you'll also have music like this, which you'll hear on the car radio. Darkseid would eventually get released in 1992 for MS-DOS, later being ported to the Amiga in 1992, the Macintosh in 1993, the Amiga CD32 in 1994 in Europe, and eventually brought to the Sega Saturn and PS1 in 1995 in Japan.
Now, let's talk about the plot of Darkseid, and I'm going to spoil some things. Darkseid takes place over the course of 3 days. You play as Mike Dawson, who has recently moved into a very large Victorian-style home in the town of Woodland Hills, California, which he got for a great deal, a suspiciously great deal. Mike hopes to use this secluded location to become a writer, which is his dream job. Now, the first night that Mike stays in the mansion, he has a nightmare, and this nightmare is of a machine opening up his skull and shooting an alien embryo into it. He wakes up with a severe migraine, and your first job is to find painkillers and take them. And there's actually a bad ending that can occur within these first moments, which is if you don't find the painkillers, he will lie down on the ground and then he will die because he has migraines that are that bad.
Yeah, and this mansion is not easy to navigate around, just as an FYI.
No. It is not. After you take those painkillers and you don't die, Mike will explore the mansion, and he ends up learning through various things that you find and read and hear from that there is a parallel universe called the Dark World. The Dark World is run by the Ancients, who are these sadistic and sinister aliens. On the second day, Mike enters the Dark World by going through a mirror in his living room and meets the Keeper of Scrolls. She tells Mike that his nightmare wasn't actually a nightmare, and he truly has an alien embryo inside of his brain. And this embryo is the Dark Seed, which, if born, will wipe out all of humanity. Not a great deal for Mike. Now, the third day consists of you stopping the Dark Seed from being born by depriving the Ancients of their power source, and then you go and destroy their connection to our world, which is the mirror. You literally take a hammer and smash the mirror. Now, if you're thinking, well, Zach, can't you take the hammer and smash the mirror on the first day if you already know this plot? I think you can, but the game will fail because the Ancients will still have their power source and they'll still awaken the Dark Seed. So you have to do things in a very specific order. And let me tell you, Darkseid's whole shtick is doing things in a very specific order.
Yeah, hence the guide.
It's a point-and-click adventure game, sure, but your job is to solve a series of puzzles in a very unique way. Darkseid does have, as mentioned, chances for it to become unwinnable. So for one thing, the moment you start the game, it cues a timer. If you don't do certain things within the time frame, the game will become unbeatable because there are certain events that happen at certain hours. You need to get to certain places by a certain time, do certain things or talk to certain people or find certain objects. And if you don't do those things, you have zero chance to do them again. again, and the game will have a bad ending and the Darkseid will be born.
I think this is also just not something that's unique to Darkseid for this time. A lot of 90s point and click adventure games also did this. There was a Robin Hood game that would do it. It would, like, depending on when you entered or went to certain locations, different NPCs were encountered. But I think Darkseid does it, from my recollection, probably some more of the most aggressive timing of making sure that everything is done right.
I feel Darkseid is at least one of the least forgiving of
right.
these games.
Yeah.
For one thing, one of the objects you have to find in the game is a paperclip that is about 2 pixels in length. It is so small, it looks like it's part of the floorboard that the paperclip is sitting on, because the paperclip is like a brown color on a brown floorboard because they could only use 16 colors. So if you miss this paperclip, which you can only find, I believe, on one of the days, the game is unbeatable. You literally can't beat the game without finding the paperclip. It's a paperclip. Like, this is the game we're dealing with. Another thing is that Mike will fall asleep at 10 p.m. regardless of where he is. Very sleepy Same. Man, and I'm the same way. So at 10 p.m., Mike falls asleep. And when he falls asleep, he enters the dark world. Now, if you fall asleep in the dark world, because you can enter the dark world whenever if you go through the mirror, you die. Do not fall asleep in the dark world. Also, you only have 3 real world hours to beat the game, because the game has a timer. So good luck. It's very unforgiving, but I think that's kind of the quirk about Darkseid. But as we'll hear from some of the reviews at the time, I think other people also found it unforgiving. And Seth, why don't you tell us a bit about what the release for Darkseid was like?
While the sales for the game weren't easy to locate, the GameDeveloper.com interview with Mike Dawson made note that Cyber Dreams as a whole was the company that would just quote unquote spend money while generating no income, which you could also take if a game designer is telling you that they might not have been able to make more than the $600,000 that they spent. Reviews of the game were easier to find, and in computer gaming world, the game was called the most integrated and effective feel for a horror adventure game yet. But they also called the game unforgiving due to the unwinnable scenarios and hard-to-find puzzles. The publication of Dragon gave the game 3 out of 5 stars. Now, Amiga Format gave the game a 72%, with a lot of praise being on the game's graphics, but criticism being placed on the strict time limit. The magazine The One gave the game an 80% while praising the graphics and controls. However, they criticized the plot. Next Generation gave the game 3 out of 5 stars, and Famicom Chushin scored the game at a 23 out of 40. The game would go on to receive some awards and nominations. It won the Cody Award for Best Fantasy Role-Playing Adventure Game from the Software Publisher Association, and it was nominated for Computer Games Strategy Plus Best Adventure Award in 1992. It would go on to lose to The Lost Files of Sherlock Holmes, The Case of the Serrated Scalpel. I think it's interesting that each publication would say one thing, be negative about another aspect, and a different publication would praise something that the other one was thought negative, and then say another, like, they're like, yeah, the graphics are good, but the plot's bad, or something. Like, yeah, each one had something else that they're like,
oh, the plot's good, but the puzzles are bad. Oh, this is good, but the time limit's bad. Yeah. I think that's fair, though.
Yeah, I wonder if they expanded the time limit or got rid of the time limit or made it more of a time limit that is game-driven instead of an actual time limit. So like a game-driven time limit, kind of like how the Gabriel Knight series does it, which pushes the time along based on when you do certain actions in the game versus an actual time clock. I wonder if they did something like that instead, it would have reviewed better and gotten better sales because, I don't know, I think a game like Darkseid has its a moment where you want to just explore around and look around and take your time. But if you know that you only have 3 hours to do it, it's kind of stressful. It's like an escape room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. It really is. Getting into the legacy, as mentioned, the game was ported to a variety of systems. The only console releases it received officially were the Amiga CD32, Sega Saturn, and PlayStation version. The Saturn and PlayStation versions were exclusive to Japan, but they were only subbed, not dubbed. Reportedly, a Sega CD version was in development. It was just not released. Oddly enough, in the world of bootlegs, there is an unofficial port of Darkseid to the Famicom by the developer Xian Mars Production in Xian, China. This port keeps most of the gameplay, but is considerably abridged, with certain scenes from the original game simply removed. What's fun is because this Famicom version doesn't have the same type of time limit restraints, there's different, like, techniques you can do to, like, pretend like the passage of time is occurring. So apparently if you click the select button 12 times, Mike just dies.
That's fun.
Now, a sequel to the game, Darkseid 2, was released in 1995. H.R. Giger would return to work on this game, and according to the game's manual, at least, Giger would actually work on the artwork himself. So it wouldn't just be like scanned artwork that he already made. He was doing original artwork for Darkseid 2. Now, according to a quote also from the manual, Giger wanted to include images that had recently been haunting him. Darkseid 2 also is a bit more influenced by David Lynch's Twin Peaks, has a bit more of a plot relative to like solving a murder in a small town versus stopping an elder god from erupting from your skull. The game is also subject to an odd urban legend about game designer Mike Dawson. There's a rumor that has been going around the internet that Mike Dawson had a mental breakdown due to the stress of the game and never worked in video games again. He actually just quit video games to go to work in TV. He wrote a few episodes of Family Matters, and as of a couple years ago at least, he was teaching at Stanford. Cyber Dreams wouldn't stay away from provocative video games. In 1995, they would go on to release I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, based on the existential horror dystopian short story by Harlan Ellison, and they brought in Harlan Ellison to personally assist them with production. So Cyber Dreams really liked getting people who were not involved in video games to work on their video games. Ellison would personally assist with the writing of the game, providing a 132-page script and helping with the overall design, and he's credited as a co-designer of I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. Cyber Dream's last game would be Noir, a shadowy thriller, released in 1996, and in 1997 they closed their doors, I believe due to bankruptcy.
Yes.
Their games they put out were bonkers good. Like, Darkseid is probably one of their weaker... Like, Darkseid's a good game, but it is arguably weaker compared to I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, which I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream is considered to be one of the best adventure games of all time. Like, just flat out.
Yeah. And I just like that they're... what is Red Hell about? Zach, hold on. Before you look it up, I'm going to read you the description of it.
So Seth is going to tell me about a game by Cyber Dreams called Red Hell.
Have you ever wondered what the world would have looked like if Stalin had achieved his goal after the war? Who would then be the first to stand on the moon? Perhaps the United States would cease to exist at all. Red Hell tries to answer these and other questions. Apparently, Red Hell is an adventure game that takes place in 2020 where the Soviets are in charge of everything. What a weird selection of games. So they did Darkseid, they did Red Hell, which was a game in between Darkseid and Darkseid 2. They did I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. They did Noir, a shadowy thriller. Between all those, they also did Cyber Race,
which is a racing game.
They did it immediately after Darkseid. I kind of buried the lead there because I didn't mention it. I wanted to ramp up to it. But yes, after Darkseid, they were like, let's make a racing game. And then they said, now let's make a game about the Soviet Union being in charge.
Then let's go back to our weird world of horror, and then let's create a game about an existential crisis.
They definitely went bankrupt, but they had some interesting stuff that they announced that they never got around to doing, such as a game called Hunters of Ralk, which would have been designed by Gary Gygax, the creator of Dungeons & Dragons. They also wanted to do Wes Craven's Principles of Fear, which was going to be based on a concept by film director Wes Craven. They were going to adapt Species and create a game called Evolver, and they also were going to do a game called Reverence and the Incredible Shrinking Character. Reverence would eventually get leaked as a playable prototype. So yeah, they had a lot of ideas, but they unfortunately, I think, ran out of money.
Yeah, they're just like, I just like the idea that they were bringing in these people who were not game designers to come up with games, because I think that's kind of an untapped market. You kind of see today, right? Hideo Kojima brought in, or wanted to bring in at least, Guillermo del Toro to work on his Silent Hill game before that was canceled. And then he ended up bringing on Guillermo del Toro as an actor to work on Death Stranding. And then you have recently Elden Ring with George R.R. Martin helping work on. It would be cool to see this kind of return of bringing in people to make video games who have nothing to do with video games, but just to see what their world is like. Like Harlan Ellison, one of the biggest, most like well-known names in sci-fi creating a video game, is crazy to me. And H.R. Giger making video games, like that's great. But alas, Cyber Dreams is no more. Anyway, we're going to get into our retro rewind. Seth had me play a cyber dream in its own right, Terminator 2 Judgment Day for the Super Nintendo. Released in 1993, it was released for both the Super Nintendo and the Genesis. I played the Super Nintendo version because that's the version Seth had me play. And it's based on the 1991 movie of the same name. It's a bad game and I hate it. I remember one time saying I hated a game. And I don't remember what game that was. I hate
Family
this
Dog.
Game. Oh yeah, Family Dog. I hate Terminator 2 Judgment Day more than Family Dog.
Wow.
Yeah. In the game, you play as the T-800, who's Arnold Schwarzenegger's character in Terminator. He has gone back in time to save a young John Connor. When you arrive in the game, you are at a truck stop or a bar, and you got to beat up dudes who hate you, and you have to find stuff from the future. It's like find future object. And these dudes are nonstop, and when you beat them up, they fall on the ground, and the game tells you they have been incapacitated non-lethally. And I'm pretty sure they get up and attack you again, because when you walk over to the next screen, more dudes come. I don't know why the killer robot from the future is refusing to murder right now, but he is, and it's frustrating.
I want to punch you all very softly.
That's another thing. His only attack when you start out is a punch. Which is barely a punch, because he's not like fully extending his arm. He's just like twitching his arm. He walks very slowly, and there's a button you can press to make him jump almost identically to Lester from Lester the Unlikely. I played through a bit of the first level. I tried to find the future devices. I found one of them, and then I got overwhelmed by guys who were throwing knives at me. And I couldn't find any guns, which is kind of like what the Terminator's known for, is his guns. You do get guns later in the game. I did see a clip of you, of like you get a machine gun later. Couldn't find it. All I had was my really bad punch. It's bad game. Does not hold up. Next week, Seth, I want you to play RoboCop versus Terminator for the Super Nintendo.
All right. Now, Zach had me play X-Men Mutant Apocalypse, developed and published by Capcom, and released for North America in 1994 and for Japan and Europe in 1995. It's an X-Men beat-em-up game from the 90s, and that's all you need to know because it's great. There is 5 different mutants you can choose from in this particular X-Men Mutant Apocalypse game. You can play as Psylocke, Wolverine, Beast, Gambit, and Cyclops. Each of the mutants have their own stage and their own powers. And the best part is, because it's a Capcom game, in order to activate your powers, you have to do Street Fighter maneuvers. If you're playing as Gambit and you want to shoot your cards, you got to do a Hadouken. Gambit shoots cards, Cyclops shoots his eye blasty, and Beast punches people in the face, because that's his mutant power, punching people.
That is his mutant power.
Anyway, so it's a fun game. Anytime that you can have X-Men and the 90s and beat them ups all in one screen, it's always a great time. In fact, I will be getting the deluxe X-Men arcade game for my basement, created by Arcade 1-Up. And this game, X-Men Mutant Apocalypse, is one of the 8 games that's included with the arcade game. So I'll soon be playing this game standing up in my basement. Overall, a great game all around. I'm glad Zach had me play it. Is it X-Men 2 Clone Wars good? No. Is it original arcade X-Men good? No. Is it still a great X-Men game? Absolutely. If you're like a true X-Men fan, there are some weird continuity issues in regards to the story. Like the Brood gets involved, you fight Apocalypse, and then you fight Magneto. Anyway, if you're looking for a beat-em-up game and you beat all the other X-Men games and you haven't played this one, take a stab at it. It's probably one of the best X-Men games on the SNES. Better ones are on the Genesis, but that's okay. Next week, Zach, you could play Pokemon Pinball for the Game Boy Color.
I will. Thank you, Seth. Now, I want to thank everyone for listening to today's podcast. I hope everyone enjoyed it. If anyone has any questions or corrections or comments, you can email us at classicgamingbrothers@gmail.com. If you want to follow us, we are available on Facebook, Classic Gaming Brothers, Instagram, Classic Gaming Brothers, X, CG Brothers Pod, Blue Sky, CG Brothers Pod, and Threads, Classic Gaming Brothers. You can also visit our website, classicgamingbrothers.com, and we're available wherever podcasts can be found. With that, Seth, am I forgetting anything?
Don't play games like my brother.
And don't play games like my brother.
I've been Seth.
And I've been Zach.
And we've been the Classic Gaming Brothers.
That's
right.
That's right.